Welcome to the second Johns Hopkins Alumni Book Club of 2010. I am Jay Lenro, graduate of the class of 1973 and an officer of the Alumni Council. We are here in the Matin Center on the Homewood campus in the Digital Media Center on a beautiful 75-degree spring afternoon, which is a very welcome change after the 81 inches of snow that fell on Baltimore this past winter. Hopkins sophomore Buddy Sola is taping this talk today, and it will be available to you on the website in transcribed form as well. It is a pleasure to introduce our faculty host, Professor Stephen David, who will discuss this month's selection, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11 by Lawrence Wright. Dr. David is Vice Dean for Programs and Centers and Professor of International Relations, Security Studies and Comparative Politics at Johns Hopkins. A graduate of Union College and Stanford University, he received his doctorate from Harvard and has taught at Johns Hopkins since 1981. He is also the director of the Jewish Studies Program at Johns Hopkins and director of the Woodrow Wilson Undergraduate Fellowship Program. Additionally, he has served as a consultant to the Department of Defense and to the Central Intelligence Agency. Please welcome Dr. Stephen David. Although the role of Al-Qaeda and the 19 terrorists who hijacked four American commercial airliners in 2001 is generally known, there is much that is still not known about this shadowy organization that continually morphs. This book covers the road that led to 9/11, in particular the role of former Egyptian pediatrician, Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. Lawrence Wright shows how the policies of the United States, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan, to name a few, had the unintended consequence of nurturing the creation of an organization that regularly commits murder in the name of religion. Dr. David, could you please share with our listeners two passages that you believe are representative of the author's writings, and discuss why you chose them?
I'd be happy to do so. The first passage is on page 194, and it's the, second paragraph in the book, and it begins this way. Why did these men, referring to the hijackers, turn against America, a highly religious country that so recently had been their ally in Afghanistan? In large part, it was because they saw America as the locus of Christian power. Once the piety of the Muslim Mujahideen and the Christian leaders of the U.S. government had served as a bond between them. Indeed, Mujahideen leaders had been considerably romanticized in the American press and had made tours through American churches where they were lauded for their spiritual courage in the common fight against Marxism and godlessness. But Christianity, especially the evangelizing American variety, and Islam were obviously competitive faiths. Viewed through the eyes of men who were spiritually anchored in the 7th century, Christianity was not just a rival, it was the arch enemy. To them, the Crusades were a continual historical process that would never be resolved until the final victory of Islam. They bitterly perceived the contradiction embodied by Islam's long, steady retreat from the gates of Vienna, where, on September 11th, that now resonant date, in 1683, the King of Poland began the battle that turned back the farthest advances of the Muslim armies. For the next 300 years, Islam would be overshadowed by the growth of Western Christian societies. Yet bin Laden and his Arab Afghans believed that in Afghanistan they had turned the tide, and now that Islam was again on the march. My second paragraph, a shorter paragraph, is on page 355, and it's at the very end. This is the view of some very bitter FBI investigators who wonder why they were never informed of the existence of Al-Qaeda operatives inside America. Meadhar and Hazmi, referring to two Al-Qaeda hijackers who had been in America for some time, Meadhar and Hazmi arrived 19 months before 9/11. The FBI had all the authority it needed to investigate these men and learn what they were up to. but because the CIA failed to divulge the presence of two active members of Al-Qaeda, the hijackers were free to develop their plan until it was too late to stop them.
Starting with that second quote, I noted that Wright spends a lot of time on the story of John O'Neill,
yes,
who was a senior FBI agent who tried to raise the alarm, yes, about bin Laden early on, and how he was thwarted in those efforts. He also details meetings that O'Neill had with the CIA where his CIA counterparts knew at the time that they were withholding vital information. And wasn't it a sad irony that O'Neill left the FBI and ended up perishing in the World Trade Center? The entire issue of the lack of cooperation is one that we've heard discussed time and again in the press. From your perspective, and having been an insider as a consultant, is that appreciably better than it was 10 years ago?
Well, I should qualify what I'm saying. I'm not really an insider. Being a sporadic consultant is not in the bowels of the government. But I am concerned that the kinds of issues brought up in the looming tower about the lack of cooperation, and the lack of sharing information, and the bureaucratic politics are still very much with us. And what frightens me is the so-called Christmas bomber in Detroit, the young man from Africa who had a bomb in his underwear, whose father had gone to the American embassy in Nigeria to warn the Americans that his son was a threat. And yet, despite this warning, despite the fact that this young man bought a one-way ticket with cash, he was allowed to board the aircraft without any special searches or scrutiny. And everyone had a reason. Everyone had an excuse. It was my job. It was their job, and so on. But it was so reminiscent of 9/11 that it was very frightening, and we wonder if we've learned anything.
The first quote, where you discussed the concept of the United States as the central Christian nation, is also an interesting one. When you look at the backgrounds of a number of the key players in the looming tower, and you note that significant numbers of them spent time in this country, I guess the perception they had of American Christianity included both the pious portions as well as those portions of our society that they saw as, lack of a better term, less pious, yeah, and somewhat more corrupt in a moral sense than the type of Islam that they professed. How did that help shape Al-Qaeda from its early adaptation and some of the thinking of its leaders?
Well, it's interesting in that, you know, as that passage suggests, in earlier times, many Muslims saw America as a strong counterpoint to the Soviet Union, as a God-fearing country that, while not Islamic, was still not atheistic and godless. But you have a group within the Islamic community, spurred on by extremist beliefs, often financed directly or indirectly by some of the more extreme elements in the Islamic community, that see any deviation from extreme virulent Islam as unacceptable and something that had to be addressed. And in a way, I chose these two passages in that they indicate to me responses to two of the central puzzles of 9/11. The first passage being, why do they hate us? I mean, why would these 19 people hijack planes, brutally kill people, and then fly these planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Is it because of what America does in terms of our policies in the Middle East and elsewhere, or is it because of who we are, a Judeo-Christian Western country? And the second passage addresses another important puzzle, and that is, why didn't we stop them? Why didn't we stop them? Why, given the $30, $40 billion we spend on intelligence, why did we fail to see the warning signs that, in retrospect, seem so clearly there? And I think the Looming Tower does a good job, especially in the first one, but in the other one as well, as confronting these two puzzles and giving at least the beginnings of responses to them.
One of the interesting characters that I frankly had not heard much about was Sheikh Abdullah Azzam.
Yes.
And his early influence on bin Laden, mm-hmm. and the interplay and jealousy by Zawahiri,
yes.
With regard to Azzam. How do you think that played into the direction that al-Qaeda took?
Well, Azzam, if I recall, is a Palestinian extremist who had a strong influence on bin Laden, as did Zawahiri. What you had was, in a sense, a struggle for bin Laden's soul, the battle as to whether the Islamic movement should fight against what they consider Israeli occupation and the existence of the State of Israel, the existence of apostate regimes, what they feel apostate regimes in the Middle East, or should it go for the so-called far enemy, the United States and the West? And too often when we look at al-Qaeda and bin Laden, we assume it came out of nowhere and all of a sudden simply just hated America, when in fact this book, The Looming Tower, demonstrates that certainly in bin Laden's early stages, he was much more focused on local issues, dealing with the Middle East, rather than hatred against America. That developed later, and the battle for his mind and soul by people like Zawahiri and Azzam and others illustrates that.
It seems as though the governments in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, to name two, have done a remarkable job in deflecting the anger toward them. The Egyptians seem to be in the crux of all of this also, and deflecting it toward the United States and the West, in a way to protect their own regimes?
Well, yes, you do have an instance where certainly the Saudis and to a certain extent the Pakistanis have indirectly supported and fostered extremist groups in the belief that this will deflect attention away from them. The problem that they've come to learn is that these extremist groups, once established, are going to strike out at their regimes as well. I mean, the Saudis faced a series of brutal attacks in 2003, 2004. The Pakistanis, who have embraced the Afghan Taliban, have found that the Taliban within their own country are enemies of the Pakistani government as well as the United States. So they're finding it difficult to ride these tigers. And I think the Saudis are trying to step back a little from their funding of these extremist madrasas, these Islamic schools, which have served as a hotbed for Islamic extremism. The notion that somehow you can support extremist groups and keep them at arm's length and buy them out has proven not to be accurate.
One of the reviewers wrote that those regimes deflected the tip of the jihadi spear away from Islamabad, Lahore, and Karachi toward Kabul, New York, and London. And that goes to what you were just saying.
Yes, but that spear has a way of turning back, and that's what these governments have seen as well.
I'm not sure we've seen the last of that, no. That challenge to those those governments. The book Milestones.
Syed Qutb, yes.
Yeah, Qutb's book seems to have been a seminal work. Can you discuss that a little?
Well, Syed Qutb is an Egyptian Islamic scholar of the Salafi school. And by that, as I understand it, he believes that the Middle East has to go back to a pure Islam, the Islam that existed at the time of the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century, and that the regimes throughout the Middle East, in fact, are not truly Islamic, including even the Saudi regime, that they just have a veneer of being Islamic, but they really are in bed with the West and have to be overthrown. And Syed Qutb was a prisoner in Egypt. He was an opponent of Nasser. And while in Egyptian prisons, he was tortured and brutalized, and wrote a series of books and wrote voluminously on his views. He was executed by Nasser. He had a chance to get out of that execution by repenting and joining the Nasserite government, and he refused and was hung as a result. But his works have been the guideposts of the Islamic movement, and certainly Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri, and many others who we would consider of the extreme Islamic school were very much influenced by him. One other note I should mention, Syed Qutb spent a couple of years in the United States.
I understand, in Greeley, Colorado.
Yes, in one of the more traditional provincial parts of America, and yet he was still appalled by what he saw, men and women dancing together and some drinking and this kind of thing. And I think in America we have this view that if only people got to know us, they would love us and want to be like us. And yet you have people like Syed Qutb, you have people like a number of the hijackers who spent considerable time in the United States, and yet this did nothing to deflect their hatred. In fact, in some cases, it reinforced it against what America is and what America stands for.
I understood that Zawahiri's uncle was one of Qutb's pupils. And so there was even a linkage between Zawahiri, who was in his middle teens,
yeah,
and Qutb's death that kind of spurred on Zawahiri's contempt for the regime in Egypt.
That's right. And I think this gets at one of the critical questions, which is worthy, of, I think, of discussion for people to look at this book. And it's what I alluded to earlier. I mean, to what extent do they hate us for our policies? By us, I mean America, for American policies, or for what we are? And in a sense, the question matters, because if it's a question of American policies, we can think about changing them. It might not be a smart thing to do, but we can think about changing them. And, you know, Osama bin Laden has made a number of demands that we should stop our support of Israel, we should stop our support of conservative Arab regimes, stop meddling in Iraq and elsewhere. And you can, and also get our troops out of Saudi Arabia. And you can reasonably think, well, can we deflect his anger and hostility by changing or modifying those policies? I, for one, think that would be a big mistake. Among other things, I don't think you send the signal out there that if you want to change American policies, kill 3,000 innocent Americans. But nevertheless, that's doable. But I think what The Looming Tower shows and what other works show is that it's more than what America does, what America is. The fact that we are a Western and somewhat Judeo-Christian, secular in parts country, that gives equal rights to women, tolerates or different points of views, is serious about gay rights, allows pornography and religious pluralism, that all the things we are drives bin Laden and his followers crazy. But I think the broader issue is, if that's who we are, since we're not going to close up shop and all become Taliban, there really isn't a lot we can do to persuade bin Laden and his followers not to attack us. What we have to do is try and prevent them from doing so, either by using preemptive strikes, such as we have with the drone aircraft in Afghanistan, better defenses, you know, border controls and such. But the notion that somehow, gee, if America were sort of harsher with Egypt and tougher on Israel, that we could stop being a target of these people, I think is horribly misguided.
In particular, you have to wonder, if Israel didn't exist, I don't think it would change the philosophy of a group like Al-Qaeda.
Now, clearly, Al-Qaeda, they're very angry at American support for Israel. But bear in mind, they're not just opposed to American support for Israel. They want Israel to die. They want it to end its existence, something I don't see America doing. But it goes well beyond Israel. I mean, they are very open as to what they want to do. They want to establish a Muslim rule throughout much of the world, at least in areas that used to have Muslim rule, and that controls the entire Middle East and goes through to Spain. And there's a belief among some of the more extreme Muslims that once a land has gone under Muslim control, as Spain was, it should never and can never go back. And it is never legitimate for it to remove itself from Muslim rule. But I do want to be careful. I mean, we're not talking about Muslims in general. I mean, most Muslims are not supportive of Al-Qaeda. They're not members of Al-Qaeda. They don't like what Al-Qaeda does. But there is a significant extremist element that, at least in the past, had been supported by the wealth and influence of countries like Saudi Arabia, which have hijacked the Islamic religion, which for the most part is a gentle and tolerant faith. They've hijacked it to pursue these nefarious ends. And one can imagine if you had extremist, ultra-Orthodox Jews with money and influence and control of the state, or fundamentalist Christians, they could pick out passages in the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament that would justify the most awful, awful policies. And that's what these extremists have done.
I think Wright does a good job of picking out ways that several of the people we've mentioned have twisted passages from the Quran to suit their own purposes. And as we've seen throughout history, although religion sometimes makes a good excuse for some of these nefarious actions, it's not necessary.
That's right. That's right. And again, it is important to note that in any great religion, you can selectively twist, interpret, extract passages that would justify the most horrific things. And that is what they have done.
The portrait of bin Laden is also very interesting.
Yeah.
I guess most Americans see him as this terribly ominous figure. But Wright almost makes him more of a figurehead whose accomplishments are more legendary in his own mind than in reality.
Yes. I mean, Wright, I think, does a good job in showing that bin Laden's exploits in Afghanistan were not as heroic or as major a deal as perhaps bin Laden and his followers would have us believe. But he also portrays bin Laden in some respects in a somewhat favorable light, not his views or what he's done. But after all, bin Laden could have led a very cushy life. I mean, he was a multi-millionaire. His father was a central figure in the Saudi establishment. I mean, his father, bin Laden Construction, built much of the infrastructure in Saudi Arabia. So bin Laden was worth, maybe still is worth, hundreds of millions of dollars. He could have acted as many Saudi princes did, whiling away the time in the French Riviera and with yachts and so forth. And I think part of his appeal is that he did not do that, that he led a very ascetic life, that he was not personally corrupt. And that he was a man of sincere religious beliefs. I mean, the fact that they are what they are maybe didn't penetrate people to the extent it should, but you can see why many saw him as a leader to be emulated.
That wealth is also, I think, an important point, because I see two things resulting from that. One is Zawahiri's desire to create his own force using bin Laden's wealth.
Yes.
And the other is the manner in which that wealth has essentially created this organization, some regards as mercenaries, mm-hmm. who are getting paid a fairly princely sum for mm-hmm. for their society to be jihadi warriors.
Yes, although I wouldn't want to push that too much, because I think a lot of the true believers of al-Qaeda are certainly not in it for the money, that they really believe America and the West and Christianity are evil and have to be fought and resisted. Nevertheless, you need money to do things. Even 9/11, they estimate cost $400,000, $500,000. You have to get people. In the case of 9/11, they needed to send people to flight schools. They needed to support them while they lived in the United States, get travel documents, bribe leaders. You need money, not huge amounts, but substantial amounts of money to do these things. And bin Laden was able to do that. And one of the points that Lawrence Wright makes is that bin Laden has been central to the success and existence of al-Qaeda, that without bin Laden, al-Qaeda probably would not have existed. It would have splintered into a variety of different groups and not been in a situation where it could have mounted the very sophisticated 9/11 campaigns. In a related situation, that raises the question of whether the United States was being a bit too cautious when we had a chance to kill bin Laden on several occasions. And as the Lawrence Wright book points out, in retrospect very painfully, I mean, we had bin Laden in our sight, so we believed to have him in our sight several times, and either because of legal, moral, or political concerns, we decided not to do it. And as a result, he was allowed to live and perpetuate the horrors of 9/11.
Isn't it somewhat ironic that those moral constraints by this society that he abhors,
yes,
don't contrast fairly well with his own lack of constraints on who's fair game, and actually saved his life?
That's right. That's right. And although in retrospect, I kind of wish we had a little less moral constraints. Bin Laden clearly has no moral constraints to do terrible harm to the United States. I mean, one of the areas that I teach at Johns Hopkins is nuclear weapons. And one of the points I try and convey to my students is that I think the world they live in today is more dangerous in terms of a nuclear or biological chemical attack than the world I grew up in, Jay, that you grew up in the Cold War. Because although during the Cold War there were many more nuclear weapons held principally by the U.S. and the Soviet Union, those who held those weapons were rational, cost-calculating actors with a return address.
Mutual assured destruction.
Exactly. We could say to the Soviets, as they did to us, if you blow us up, we'll blow you up in return. And since they didn't want to be blown up in return, they didn't blow us up, even though they always held the capability to do so and do so today. Now, just imagine if bin Laden had a nuclear weapon in Baltimore.
There's nobody to retaliate against.
What could we say to him? He said, I'm going to blow this up next week. What do we say? We say, bin Laden, you better not blow up Baltimore, because if you do, we'll do what? There's no clear what at the end. And that's what makes al-Qaeda and groups like it so especially dangerous. They are undeterrable.
What do you think the most important issue that you can single out to the readers that they would find really interesting to discuss online?
I think the two issues that I would look at online, one has to do with the source of the anger of bin Laden and his followers against America. Just why is it they hate us so much? And the second online issue, again, is reflecting the passages I mentioned. Why couldn't or didn't America do more before 9/11? After all, 9/11 wasn't the first attack. As the Lawrence Wright book shows in a very clear fashion, our embassies were attacked in Kenya and in Tanzania. The USS Cole was attacked in 2000, all by al-Qaeda. And you had people like John O'Neill and others who identified...
Abdul Rahman's attempt to blow up the World Trade Center.
That's right. I mean,
before.
That's a good point. It was in 1993. Abdul Rahman, I think the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, tried to blow up the World Trade Center before. So we had ample warnings that they were out there, that they were prepared to use violence against us. And yet, you know, you get these reports, you have reports from the FBI. Well, gee, you've got a lot of young Arab men learning to fly planes. This is of concern. I think one of the FBI people even went so far as to say, we don't want one of them flying a plane into the World Trade Center. And yet these reports were shrugged off or compartmentalized. The CIA didn't talk to the FBI, who didn't talk to the NSA, who didn't talk to the White House. No one talked to anyone. And these guys were able to live in America for as long as they did, make their plans, and go unimpeded to launch the attacks on 9/11.
It's also interesting how a lot of these forces seem to emerge and become stronger after the end of the Cold War.
Yes. I think the end of the Cold War created space for other movements to emerge. And the collapse of the Soviet Union gave confidence to people like bin Laden that, gee, these superpowers are really paper tigers. And they took the credit themselves, that it was bin Laden and his band of maybe a couple of thousand at most Arab fighters that brought down the Soviet Empire. Of course, this is nonsense. But he believed it, or at least professed to believe it, and his followers believed it. And this gave them sort of sustenance to continue what they feel is the next struggle.
Is there anything else you think the readers would be interested in knowing?
I think the readers should spend some time with the back of the book first, because the back of the book outlined some of the principal characters, many of whom Lawrence Wright interviewed. And it's sometimes hard to keep track of everyone. A lot of people come in and out. So to get a sense of just who is who, it might be good to start with the back of the book first. But I think the readers will find this book to be a very accessible, very clear, easy to follow account. And so much of what we read is post 9/11. It's useful to see something that gives us the basis and foundation for what led up to 9/11. And it should be remarked to the readers that the actual attacks of 9/11 are not addressed in this book at all. This is not a book about 9/11. It's a book about what preceded it.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. David. To our participants, please note that Dr. David will be posting approximately 6 questions on the website for your online discussion during the month of April, and he will be lurking in the background and adding to that discussion as he can. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next month.
Thank you.